Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, April 24th. The next 2 days are critical internal deadlines for hundreds of bills that survived the legislative session. We check in on the hot-button issues still in play. Across the country, states are wary about potential deep cuts to Medicaid. We take a closer look at who benefits from the program and hear about a campaign to collect stories about what a lifeline the program can be for residents in Hawaii. Massive donations of clothing to help Maui fire victims have created a bit of a problem. We check in on an effort to sort through the heaps. Federal funding for the humanities is on the cutting room floor. We meet students advancing to a national competition, which has an uncertain future. Plus, we spotlight an award-winning ballroom. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Lots of critical issue bills still in play at the state legislature. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo is here with us this morning. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
Yeah, so where are we at with things like, you know, gambling and fireworks? Because those were really important issues at the beginning of session.
Yeah, exactly. So I think one thing that we're watching really closely right now is a bill that would legalize online sports betting. Technically, this has not yet had a conference committee, which is the point where, you know, after the bill passes out of both chambers, the House and the Senate have not agreed upon language for that bill. And so right now they're in this phase where they're trying to negotiate and come up with final bill language so that they can take a final vote and pass these bills out. So right now, the legalizing online sports betting bill, this bill has received conferees, which are the people who are going to be negotiating these bills on the Senate side, but none have yet been appointed on the House side. But I spoke with Representative Daniel Holt, who introduced the bill, and he says that they're still discussing it and it's still on the table. We're in this period of time where there's a lot of legislative deadlines. So technically, if your bill was not referred to the Finance Committee or Ways and Means Committee, one of the money committees in the House or the Senate, you have until today to make it out of conference. For bills that do have a referral or have been referred to Ways and Means, one of the money committees, your bills actually have until tomorrow to make it out. So those are kind of the two deadlines we're tracking here. And this legalizing online sports betting bill does have that money committee referral. So it has actually until tomorrow to pass out of one of those conference committees.
Right. And even sometimes when they schedule conferences and everybody gathers in the room and then they kick it off for later in the
right,
day.
Right. Yes. So it's interesting because once they open up the conference committee on a bill, they can kind of move it and change it around in the schedule as many times as much as they want. The only thing they're held to is that when they're going to do the very first conference committee, they're supposed to give a one-day notice, but they can always waive that if they vote on it and decide to waive that rule.
And then did they decide on anything with fireworks?
No, so fireworks are still being considered. There's a bill that's up for conference committee today and has been up for conference committee for the past couple of days and keeps getting kicked day to day to day. It would basically, the one that's still alive, would amend, you know, the definitions of fireworks offenses, separate out lower fireworks offenses from higher ones, and increase some penalties, and, you know, allow HPD officers to give out fines. And another one that we're watching that's regarding fireworks would allow drone footage to be used as evidence when they're trying to prosecute these types of crimes. So those bills are still, you know, going through conference.
And so what other hot topic issues are you tracking?
So one of the things I thought was kind of interesting was a bill that I thought that was not going to get a hearing is getting a conference committee about pretrial release. And so this bill would mandate that if a judge is ordering monetary bail, that it be set at an amount that a person can actually afford. You know, as we've probably heard, you know, OCCC, the jail here on Oahu is overcrowded. And so they're trying to think of ways to decrease the amount of people in this overcrowded jail. You know, people who support this bill pose the question, you know, if a person is dangerous enough that they should be held pretrial, why should it depend on how much money they can afford to pay? So this bill is being heard today in conference to kind of hash it out and see if they can get to a final bill that the full legislature can vote on. And this is all kind of on the backdrop of the budget that passed earlier this week, which allocated about $30 million for planning to reconstruct the Oahu jail, and that's been part of the budget. Other big ticket items that we're still following that we don't know about how it's going to shake out is a bill that's regarding the electric utility. And this bill would, you know, cap the liability for property damage at $1 billion in the case of another catastrophic wildfire for HECO. And it would allow HECO to securitize, which means issue bonds backed by ratepayers to pay for necessary infrastructure upgrades. And it's certain that this bill would increase your electric bill. But if it doesn't pass, it's not clear how HECO would pay for these critical infrastructure upgrades.
What else is there on the tourism front?
Yeah, on tourism, there's a bill to increase the transit accommodation tax, which is that tax that's levied on hotels, by about 1%. And then it would also charge cruise ships $20 per passenger when they dock in Hawaii, and would allocate some of those funds to climate resiliency. You know, one of the crucial things about this bill is that currently cruise ships don't pay any transit accommodations tax. So this is trying to, you know, kind of level the playing field for hotels as well as cruise ships. And originally this bill was supposed to go all to climate resiliency, but they've kind of changed the framework of this and they're still deciding, you know, how much money would be going to climate resiliency efforts.
And where are we at on the green fee?
That's the bill, actually.
Okay.
The green fee bill. That's what it's turned into. Yeah.
So
the Green City Bill is now this transit accommodations tax bill, and it's not necessarily all of that is not going directly to climate resiliency, but there is a portion in that bill that would allocate funds directly to climate resiliency from the general fund.
Okay. All right. Well, lots of things still in play. We appreciate you tracking all this, and we'll see what plays out before the end of session next week.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Ashley. We've been talking to HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Check out her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
The United Soybean Export Council used to bring soybean buyers from China and take a tour in the fall and bring them to the farm so they can see what kind of a crop we're going to have. We need to have that relationship. And if a farmer can help it along, so be it.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
We go through life trying to figure out what other people are thinking and feeling. It's something we do automatically.
We need to read people's intentions in any ordinary interaction, like having a conversation and figuring out what to say and how to respond.
What happens when we get it wrong? This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Lawmakers are on guard for what could happen with federal funding for our Medicaid program. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has calculated that federal budget goals could not be reached without cuts to Medicaid. The program helps our most needy families, and this year marks 60 years since it was established. Nationally, one in five seek assistance. Here in Hawaii, it is nearly one in three. Qualifying can also unlock additional wraparound services. We recently spoke with Francoise Cully-Trotman about why raising the profile of the program is so important. She's the CEO of Aloha Care, and it just launched a campaign to get residents to share their stories about how Medicaid has helped them.
In Hawaii, we have over 400,000 people who are covered by Medicaid. The numbers are quite significant. That's about a third of our island. And in that number, we have one in three that are children. They're our keiki. So that hits very close to home for us. And as another example, about the third of the births in Hawaii are covered by the Medicaid program. So lots of our friends and neighbors are covered by Medicaid for their inpatient and outpatient care. It's very extensive, everything from dental care to eye care, home and community-based services. So it is the safety net. That's what people rely on when they have no other coverage or when life has changed. So life can change very suddenly for some of our residents. And so if they lose commercial coverage, Medicaid is the safety net.
You know, we hear daily about potential cuts to Medicaid, and, you know, everybody's bracing for what that could mean. I know our lawmakers are still in session, and they may come back for a special session if need be. But what is it you want to, I guess, drive home about Medicaid?
And we are aware of the resolution that was recently passed. We've been watching and monitoring. We're very fortunate in Hawaii because we have elected officials. We have our director of MedQuest who oversees the Medicaid program and many other community partners that are very committed to protecting the Medicaid benefit for recipients. So I think just to set the tone, that's most critical for folks to know is that we have a group of stakeholders on these islands that are really advocating to take care of people. I think sometimes people forget that Medicaid goes way beyond just medical coverage. It really opens the door, together with the health insurance plans that provide coverage, for folks to have access to social care, such as housing and education, et cetera. And so the five health plans who are here that help to administer that program are also providing additional wraparound type services that really support the people that live in our communities.
I know that it's regarded as a safety net, and so it is kind of scary for people to think, gosh, you know, our most needy use this program, and if there's not something there to help catch them, right, what will happen?
So we think of this in terms of the impact on our community's ability to just continue meeting their basic needs and to continue to tackle some of the chronic illnesses, et cetera, that they're tackling. But the second aspect of this is there's astronomical costs that could be passed on to our state and to providers, and also burden the healthcare system. Without adequate coverage, we will see a reduction in preventative care. And so most people will resort to going to the ER, for example, for their care. That is not an optimal way to manage health and wellness.
Yes, and
overall,
we've seen a lot of our health leaders out there saying, no, you know, we need to do better because you cannot be putting that kind of pressure on the emergency rooms.
Yeah, and I think our state is really emerging out of a situation where we've tackled COVID and the fires in Lahaina, et cetera. And so we see what happens when we burden the healthcare system in Hawaii. And so that is a concern. Those are some of the things that the stakeholders and the health plans like myself were tackling and trying to anticipate and plan for.
Gosh, you are asking people to talk about what Medicaid means to them.
Yeah. We, for example, have opened up our website for folks to share their stories. Our lawmakers, the other stakeholders who are advocating, are collecting those stories so that they can communicate to the folks in D.C. and the decision makers and help them understand what it looks like to not have coverage or to not have access. And so we are asking people to go to our website, share your stories. We've collected quite a few stories already. We opened this up maybe 2 weeks ago, and we have over 30 stories from the community about how Medicaid has impacted or helps to support them.
Can you share an example? Of?
Yeah. We actually had a former employee of ours that is now in the hospital system that shared her story of her and her boys being on Medicaid when her husband passed away, and had it not been for that support, how difficult it would have been for her to get back on her feet, get back into the educational system, and so on. Medicaid is a safety net, but we also have folks that are students, for example, that just don't have alternate coverage, and so they're also covered by the program.
Well, I bumped into a friend of mine at the grocery store the other day, and he was concerned for his adult son who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he just worries that he's going to lose coverage. We've seen so many things happen abruptly. You know, you've had the rug pulled out from under you. It sometimes is unsettling to figure out, well, what do I do next?
Yeah. And we tell our our members, and this goes for anyone who's covered by Medicaid, to please know that as of today, there have not been any changes, to take full advantage of the coverage that you have, to reach out to us if you're worried so we can proactively get you to care. And they can also reach out to our Hawaii MedQuest division if they're worried about their coverage or need to submit documentation and so on. But we do encourage people to reach out to Aloha Care. We're here. We're here to listen. But moreover, we're here to connect folks to services.
And it's tough because, you know, your mental health is just being bombarded daily with so many threats. And so that's scary. Particularly, let's say, for maybe the elderly.
And we are also doing education. So in addition to convening forums where folks can speak openly about their challenges and concerns, we are educating our providers. We are providing materials and little trinkets for Medicaid Awareness Month so they can in turn also respond to their patients and help to answer their questions or help them to connect them to someone who can.
But the idea is if you share your story, you can then maybe amplify those voices to the policy makers as they're looking to contract the program.
That's right, Catherine. I don't think that we can overlook how powerful that is. And we need to remember that many of the decision makers are not involved in the day-to-day. So collecting those stories, sharing your perspective, speaking up about your concern is really powerful right now.
So that is a way to empower yourself, is to make sure that the people who need to know the good that happens with the funding for these programs is important.
Exactly. We also have lawmakers that have been on Medicaid at some point in their lives. I think collectively hearing from the community, hearing from those who have Medicaid today really has the power to help change some of the things that we are apprehensive about.
Okay. So again, how can people do this?
First, we encourage folks to go to our website. It's very easy, and it's www.alohacare.org. And prominently, you will see a place where you can share your story. We also encourage folks to, if you're seeing a provider today, a physician, non-clinical folks, even your therapist as part of the Medicaid program, thank them. Remind them of their own power to speak up and how critical it is that they're delivering services that help to create balance for you and in many cases help with the better quality of life.
Yes, because we often take for granted our caregivers.
That's right.
Yeah, people need to share their stories and hopefully those voices will reach people's hearts.
Yes. Essentially. And we're in the right community for that. I think for us as the months unfold, there will be undoubtedly a lot of uncertainty. To remind our membership and to remind the community that there's always someone there that's listening and always someone there that's willing to help. I think it's one of Hawaii's strengths and it has seen us through some of the most difficult times. We look forward to navigating whatever is coming together with our community.
That was Francoise Cully-Trotman, CEO of Aloha Care, the third largest health plan in Hawaii, which provides Medicaid services for our community. Look for links on our website later today.
Hawaii Public Radio is looking for an experienced accounting professional to join us part-time. If you're detail-oriented, community-minded, and love HPR, we invite you to apply by April 30th. For pay range and details, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii Foundation. Its 4UH for Hawaii campaign connects donors with UH to seek new ways to sustain and conserve island resources. UHFoundation.org.
not long after donations came pouring in after the Maui wildfire disasters, it became clear that a real problem was developing. You know, lots of the clothing was ending up in the landfill. Community groups have been working to divert unusable items from the landfill. HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel recently checked in on how they're doing. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so the county identified that the textile trash was a problem with the landfill before the fires.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's no secret that a huge amount of clothing winds up in the landfill. This isn't just unique to Maui. The county of Maui says in 2021 about 6,000 tons of textiles annually, you know, go into the landfill. And that's a huge amount. So there's a group called Circular Hawaii that was founded by a group of volunteers before the fire. And they are working to help try and keep some of this clothing out of the landfills. You know, clothing waste is a huge issue, was before the fire. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, this huge overflowing of donations, clothing donations in the wake of the fire, you know, a lot of those did go to people in need, but a lot of them, you know, are still sitting unsorted and unused in containers and warehouses across Maui. And so it's a huge issue. So this group is sorting the clothing. They are distributing it based on its condition and potential uses. So, you know, it's going to targeted community groups who are able to connect it to people who can actually use the clothing in good condition. And they're finding a whole bunch of different ways to recycle it, upcycle it, shred it, compost it. So they're coming up with some really interesting ways to keep the clothing out of the landfills. And I was there with them in Lahaina when they opened up this 20-foot container, just overflowing with donations, you know, from the fire. And it's still sitting there more than a year and a half later. And so they're now, you know, after kind of the immediate, you know, need and all the activity surrounding recovery efforts, now, you know, everyone's kind of taking a step back and this group is trying to figure out, you know, what do we do? What can we do with this clothing that was donated, you know, with so much aloha to keep it out of the landfill? So local Maui thrift stores are like just overloaded. They can't keep up with all the clothing. And this group of about a dozen volunteers spent, you know, hours sorting clothing from this container, got only about a third of the way through in the one day that, you know, they were doing it. It's certainly an ongoing effort. Circular Hawaii volunteer Kiara Harder explains kind of their sorting process and where the clothing ends up.
So as I'm going through these clothes, I am looking for, first of all, is it usable? So is it in good condition? Does it have a stain? Does it have a rip? Would somebody wear it again? It doesn't look like a rag. If it all looks good, then it goes into the gift pile, and that's where we gift it with a bunch of our community partners, whether it's the Keiki Exchange, local thrift shops, local churches, or people that were impacted by the fire that do need clothes. We also work with the hospital and some other houseless organizations, so they will take some clothes as well for people coming from off the streets or coming from out of the hospital. And then if it's not wearable, it gets sent into two different categories. So the first category is compost. So if it's not wearable, if it's stained or ripped, and it can be composted, it's wool or linen or cotton, 100%, then we can put it into the compost pile, and those will get shredded and then commercially composted here on the west side, which is really exciting. And then if it fails all of those tests, the final category is the shred. So we can shred anything, polyester, any kind of blends, but just things that can't be composted, that can't go back to the land, that are synthetic fibers. Those go into the shred pile. So then we take them to an industrial shredder where we shred them up into little pieces. And then from there, we can make them into new things like pillows and dog beds. And we have a couple different projects we're working on.
Interesting. I never thought about that. Dog beds.
Yeah. So one of the really cool things they're doing, as she mentioned, is composting. So the West Maui Green Cycle is a commercial facility for composting in Lahaina. And co-founder Gretchen Lozano is also a Circular Hawaii volunteer. Was heavily involved in fire recovery efforts, and she's really excited to start exploring composting natural fibered clothing scraps. And so it's something new. you know, I think it's done in other places, but this is the first time since the Maui Green Cycle facility was founded in 2019 that they will be recycling clothing. And so it's a really interesting concept that they are looking forward to exploring. The group also got a County of Maui grant from the Department of Environmental Management to, you know, supporting them in figuring out these solutions. So, like, maybe, you know, could use it for housing insulation, all of this clothing. Maybe it could be used for, you know, building blocks mixed with, you know, natural glue. There's so many different ideas out there. And so the grant is helping support that exploration. It's also going towards supplies. They're getting an industrial washer and dryer, more storage for some of these things until they can work through sorting, you know, so much clothing that's out there. So one step at a time. And, you know, it's interesting to see them exploring these different options and hopefully keeping.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, is there a particular site where they're trying to do all this work?
So they go to different areas. The day that I joined them, they were at the Maui Green Cycle facility in Lahaina. They had loaded the container there, but they meet all over the place, wherever's needed to go through on a monthly basis.
All right. Well, interesting story, but thank you so much, Catherine.
Thanks so much.
We've been hearing from HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwet-Pakta. Look for her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii History Day brought 46 schools, 85 teachers, and more than 5,000 students from across the islands to Windward Community College. This year, the theme, Rights and Responsibilities, came to life through performances, exhibits, websites, documentaries, and essays. Marlena Domer, Audrey Matarazzo, and Shailene Padron are 8th graders at David Kalakaua Middle School in Kalihi. The students took home first place in the performance category and a ticket to the national competition in Washington, D.C. But their trip is up in the air because of deep cuts to the National Endowment for the Humanities at the hands of the Trump administration. Now the future of the 40-year-old competition is in doubt. The middle schoolers and their teachers spoke with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about their performance. Their advisor, Jamie Valerio, begins by describing how the competition is organized.
National History Day is a nationwide contest where students are able to find a topic that relates to the History Day theme. This year's History Day theme was Rights and Responsibilities. So students are required to develop a project. There's 5 different categories. You can make a performance, an exhibit, a website, a documentary, or a paper. And then you can do this as an individual or as a group. The driving factor behind History Day is just giving students the autonomy to learn what they want to learn. Students are able to pick topics that they believe match the theme best, and then they create a thesis, conduct their research, and argue how their topic matches the theme.
So, and Audrey, tell me a little bit about how the three of you arrived at the Equal Pay Act for what you wanted to focus on.
So originally, we knew that we wanted to do a topic that was based off of women's rights. And we had 2 topics, which were abortion rights in Hawaii and the Equal Pay Act in 1963. We chose the Equal Pay Act in 1963 because we knew that personally, us three, we would like to capture the actions of the topic because we knew that it could emphasize how people perceive the Equal Pay Act. And we also knew that it would fit the topic the best.
It does seem to fit the theme really well. And those seem like 2 very timely topics that you were considering. Marlena, tell us about how the three of you came up with the presentation that you have. There's a lot of elements to it in terms of visuals and movement and rhythm. What was the collaboration like?
We all collaborated into constructing our script as well as our movements. We also took what we knew from secondary sources from our research, and we also incorporated some of our primary sources into a performance. We just took as much time as possible to memorize, plan, and construct our performance to really make our performance really stand out.
Boss, thanks, boss. Another paycheck of hard work. $200. I'm gonna take them myself to a nice dinner tonight.
$200? I only got $118. That's like a 40% difference. Why is my paycheck always less than his? We do the same job and work the same hours.
Isn't it obvious? I'm a man and you're a woman.
Shailene, tell us how you came up, the three of you came up with that text.
We use primary sources since it gave us information from people that actually experienced stuff from that time.
Marlena, how did learning about the Equal Pay Act affect how you think about history and how it relates to the world you're living in now?
Well, before competing in National History Day, I didn't really know how much history affected the world. But I realize now that learning about history really affects the world that we live in. Researching about the Equal Pay Act of 1963 really opened up our eyes to see what the struggles women faced back then. But it also helps us as young women to take a step forward into fighting for what is right. And as young women and people of color, we don't want to be discriminated against in the workforce, and we just hope for a better future. We know that fighting for what is right is not automatic, but it really takes courage and effort and really passion for what we think is right.
Mr. Valerio,
talk a little bit too about the internal process. How does the school decide who will represent the competition?
The students, they apply for History Day if they want to be in History Day at our school. And then once they apply, they're put into my class, or there's another History Day class as well. So we have two classes of History Day, and we use that to base our curriculum off project-based learning. So that's kind of our model for developing a project, is using project-based learning. But in terms of the competition, there's two levels here in Hawaii. First is the district level. So we are in the Honolulu district. I believe there's about 7 or 8 districts here in Hawaii. And then once you place at the district competition, you move on to states, which is where they competed. And then once you place at states, there's the national competition that will be happening in June. So that's kind of the format. Yeah.
Well, and I know that getting everyone to DC is not something that can be done for free. So I know it'll cost some money. And as I understand it, the school does have some funds to at least start that process of funding the trip. But the school also relies on some funding partners to make it happen. And I know there's been some changes in federal funding and so forth. Can you talk a little bit to that and whether or not dynamics in the federal government right now are affecting the funding for the trip to DC?
So thankfully, shout out to my principal. He's really good at planning ahead. So he really budgeted for us to make it there. And we're still on the process of making sure we have the monies for that. We are from a Title I school, so we do have a little bit backing from the federal government. In terms of funding, though, the future of History Day and the National History Day competition is kind of up in the air right now, unfortunately. The Endowment for the Humanities funded a lot of Hawaii History Day and the Hawaii Council for the Humanities. And a lot of their grants just got cut by Dodge. So yeah, that's something sadly I don't want to think about right now, but the future of History Day is definitely up in the air, sadly. Even for the national competition this year, because the endowment funding did cut, we needed to fundraise for the national competition to even happen this year. So even for this year, we're already affected. But I think we made just enough for the national competition to happen and for the Hawaii delegation to make it up there to DC this year. But in terms of the future, yeah, it's going to be a little rough.
So it was just before the state fair, a couple of days before the state fair, that you found out the news about the National Endowment for the Humanities, correct?
Yeah, it was really tough. I didn't even want to tell the kids about it because I really wanted to just have them focus on the state competition first. But yeah, that was definitely like a kind of like a wake-up call for sure.
Yeah. And it looks like about 90% of the funding for the Hawaii Council for the Humanities, which is responsible for the Hawaiian History Day, among other important programs, it's funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. So you're right to speak to that precarity for the future.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just raising awareness, I think, is really important to at least help support the council and for support these student programs. Yeah.
Well, I share your gratitude toward your principal. Let's give a shout out. What's his name?
Principal Grindel.
For having the foresight to plan ahead so that our current winners have the opportunity to travel to DC, it looks like. And I'm grateful to hear that. Audrey, we've made so many strides, so many improvements in society in terms of how we view women in the workplace and society writ large. More work to be done, though, still, no? Talk about what you'd like to see, what improvements you think that are still out there that we can make as a society.
So hopefully our performance can be seen or noticed with the right and great amount of people that we want to inform. And we hope that our performance inspires a lot more people to do more, meaning maybe talk about it more or maybe stand up against these injustices. And we hope to see the successes of other people's help from getting inspired from our performance.
Marlita, same question to you. What do you hope to see as someone moving on with your educational career, will be entering the workforce down the line? What improvements do you think we still have to make as a society?
Well, I hope for through our performance and performing at nationals where we get a broader audience, we hope to, again, what Audrey said, inspire others to really stand up for what is right. Step out of your comfort zone. It's okay. It's really important for us as this generation to really care about what's happening around the world and how learning about this history will affect how we live and interact and just really shape the world we live in.
Shape the world we live in. I think that's the best we can do as students coming into the world. Shailene, same question to you.
I hope that women's pay is, I hope it rises since in our performance, we said that women still don't have equal pay since it's at like around 80% compared to men. So I hope that's something that would be changed and maybe for more people to realize that women still today are affected by the Equal Pay Act since their wages aren't fully equal to men's.
Have any of you ever been to Washington, D.C.?
No.
No? Audrey, are there any expectations you have of Washington, D.C. or things you'd like to do when you go?
So I've actually never been out of state. So I hope to see the museums there, the statues, generally the basic things that you would expect to see because of how much it's been talked about. But one specific thing I kind of want to go to is Trader Joe's.
Very popular here in Hawaii.
It's a very popular thing here in Hawaii, and I just really want to see where it's been. So
walk away with one of those famous tote bags, huh?
Exactly.
Marlena, same to you. What are your expectations of DC? Any hopes you have for the trip?
Well, my expectations for this trip is to really be safe for this whole trip. I expect to learn many other topics about history from nationals competition. I also really want to explore the authentic things that I see, the museums and like the memorials, all of that. I'm just really excited to have fun and spend time with the people who've been supporting us and really brought us to this point in time.
I love the point that you make about going there to learn as well. You're going to go there to share a story and something you've worked on really hard for a long time and have succeeded with winning first place here in Hawaii. But there's also a lot of information you're going to be able to absorb while you're there. Yeah, it'll be rich. Shailene, any hopes or aspirations in terms of the trip to DC?
Oh, I really hope to spend more memories with my friend and Mr. Valerio right before we go to high school since it's the summer before we go back.
And Mr. Valerio, I know we had some other students from Kalakaua Middle School do very well at the competition. Can you give us a little summary of some other students who placed and might be moving on as well?
We also placed second as well in the performance category. We had a Supreme Court case on same-sex marriage. We also placed first in documentary, and I believe that was on the Kuleana Act. And then we also got first place in the group exhibit on another Supreme Court case, Fred Korematsu. And we also got third place as well for individual exhibit for the Delano Grape Strike, as well as third place for paper on the Kalama Valley protests. And then the top two place in each category will be moving on to DC.
David Kalakaua Middle School crushing it with all of these placements at the state history competition. That's fantastic. Well, Mr. Valerio, any other thoughts you'd like to share with listeners about the experience and State History Day?
I just want to say I'm really proud of my students. They inspire me to just keep working hard. I'm so proud of them, and I've seen them grow so much from this opportunity. And I just really want to say if you have the money, if you could support the humanities, if you could support the council, Hawaii Council for the Humanities, honestly, anything makes a difference because, we're from Kalihi and, our community, we do face a lot of, adversity, I think, than most communities do. But I believe that History Day and, programs like this give my students a voice and give them experiences that they would not be able to have. And I'm just really thankful for the opportunity, and I'm glad that I'm their teacher.
We've been hearing from the first place winners at the State's History Day competition who spoke with HPR's D.W. Gibson. We wish the students luck as they prepare to compete at the national level in Washington, D.C. in June. Nation.
Who run the world? Girls, who run the world? Girls. HPR's Live from the Atherton presents two events featuring Hawaii fiction authors. On May 15th, HPR welcomes Megan Kamale Kakimoto and Christiana Kahakawila. On May 22nd, HPR welcomes Kai Gaspar and Brandy Nalani McDougall. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
The Trump administration ran TV commercials in Mexico discouraging immigration. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum denounced the ads.
Hacer propaganda política ideológica.
They're making political and ideological propaganda in our country, she said. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Hula takes the stage tonight at the 62nd Annual Merry Monarch Festival in Hilo, beginning with the Miss Aloha Hula competition. As we celebrate artistry and tradition, we thought we'd highlight another group of award-winning dancers competing at the highest levels. The Ballroom Dance Club at the University of Hawaii at Manoa recently defended their national title at the National Collegiate Dance Sport Championships in Pittsburgh. Three club members stopped by our studios and spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender. Andrew Lin and Micaela Villanueva are both students at UH, and Ravi Narayan is the club's president, coach, and a computer science instructor at UH. Narayan's students say he teaches one of the hardest classes in the major, so it came as a surprise when he offered this deal on the first day of class.
I don't know how and why I did this, but on a whim, I suddenly said, you know what, if you show up for ballroom dance class tomorrow, I'll give you extra credit. And many of the students were taken aback. They sort of stared at me and said, who's teaching the class? I said, I am. And some almost fell off the chair, but they were curious. So we walk into our first class, my wife and I, Cynthia. She's the choreographer and the instructor for the club as well. As we're walking through, I told my wife, if we have one student, we're still going to continue the club. We're going to teach because we had no idea if anybody would show up. And we go there a few minutes early. There's about three students there. And then at 6 o'clock when we start, I see a whole bunch of my computer science students coming. They're sort of all giggling and sort of smiling away, you know. And rest is history. Our plan was maybe in 5 years we would eventually try to compete, because it was, we really started to spread the joy of ballroom. There was no really intent to turn this into a competitive team. But 2 years later, we went to nationals last year, and we actually won, which was quite unexpected. And we did that again this year. So,
Andrew, talk about how you joined the team and why.
I still remember the date. I joined last semester, September 17. It started out as a friend. My friend, he was doing ballroom dancing, and I was just talking to him. It was on a Tuesday, and he was like, hey, we got this ballroom practice at 6 p.m. Do you want to come check it out? And at the time, I'm a senior at my classes. I was very kind of stressed with all the schoolwork at the time, really wanted to find something to like de-stress, decompress, don't think about school at all. And I just say, why not? And I showed up. I remember I was talking to Ravi. I was like, hey, Ravi, I'm in your computer science class. This is my first time coming. Yeah. And from there, I just kind of stuck to it. And somehow I got convinced into competing, joining the national team, and here I am.
And if I may add, well, he did get extra credit for the computer science class, but also Andrew only started last semester, and at nationals this year, he took a couple of first places. So,
Oh my gosh.
And that's pretty amazing, because he's competing against about 70, 75 other partnerships on the floor. So,
how much extra credit are we talking? Is this like 5 points? Is this a letter grade?
I give them about a couple of percent of the total grade. I've been trying to actually get away from it because that was really the promotion, but somehow word has gotten around. So this semester, I didn't really offer it, and the students sort of themselves assigned to each other and said, oh, you get extra credit for this. So I was sort of obligated after a point to continue with that. So,
and Mikaela, talk about your journey to this club also, why you joined.
Yeah, so I joined the spring semester of my freshman year, actually. So that was the beginning of 2023. And as a freshman, I was just looking around for clubs to join. And ballroom is actually a part of the Association of Computer Machinery. So that's like the ICS club at our school. It's one of the clubs underneath that. And on the first day of my ICS class, there was this guy who came up to talk about it. And he was so unenthusiastic about having to talk about ballroom dancing, even though he's a computer science major. I remember he went up and he was just like, I don't even know why I have to talk about this. Like, this is ballroom dancing, but like Ravi made me do it. And I thought it was so funny. So I told my friend, we should try this out, kind of as a joke, because, you know, he hates it. And so we showed up to practice and then kind of just stood there or been there ever since.
And Mikhail also took first place in a couple of events this national. So,
Ravi, do you think there are any transferable skills between computer science and ballroom dancing? Is there maybe a way of thinking or some of the lessons you teach, or it's just fully a result of you told your students about it and they showed up to the club?
I'm actually glad you asked that, because I always joke that STEM, there's actually a fifth letter missing in there, which is a silent B. So it's actually STEMB, and the B stands for ballroom. Because what's missing in STEM is communication skills, teamwork, coordination, all of which you get through ballroom. So it actually is a perfect complement for anyone in STEM, because, you know, employers are looking for that. And there's something about ballroom that appeals to both the left and right side of the brain. It has a certain structure which appeals to people like me and Andrew, who are very, I guess, not exactly what you would think of as sort of natural dancers. We are, you know, very much engineering, computer science people. But there's something about it that just, you know, attracts us.
Andrew, can you think of a time where you learned, you know, some of those transferable skills, or you feel like ballroom dance taught you something about life skills or the mm-hmm. way you think about the world?
Yeah, I was thinking, I think in general, it's really about understanding yourself, how your body moves, and also needing to understand someone else, because you dance as a couple. And that takes a lot of communication, that takes a lot of teamwork, and that takes a lot of drive to be able to pursue, to want to be a better dancer. So you have to keep striving to get better, you have to persevere through it. And I guess in the computer science sense, it's like any programming assignment, you have to be very stubborn. Like you code, you get some bugs, you try to find out why. Sometimes it takes hours just to get to one problem, but then you have that discipline, just continue to push forward to solve that problem. And it's kind of similar to ballroom. It's like you want your body to move in the way you want it to be, like to create sort of a beautiful movement. And that takes time, that takes effort, takes a lot of discipline. And I think that the idea of the discipline, the perseverance, is really good life skill to have both in ballroom and then in a STEM field.
And any thoughts there, Mikhaila? Or?
Actually, I think I'm like the least computer science student in the club. I remember Ravi told me at one point that there's like a correlation between how well you do in ballroom with how well you do in his class. And at the time he said that, I was actually failing his class. So, and we had a competition coming up too. It was really stressful. But one thing that I kind of learned, like, because I'm still in computer science, is that it just takes time. I don't think I have a natural affinity to either computer science or dancing, but I put in a lot of time to practice both skills and I get by. So I think just understanding that there's hard work and that there's talent, and then it just takes a lot of time to compensate for that.
Ravi, talk about what nationals were like.
When we went last year for our first nationals, we had 10 students. And really the goal at that time was to give them an idea of what a competition looks like outside of Hawaii. We had one student who had never traveled outside to the mainland. So it was more just experience. So I had no expectation of us doing extremely well, I wasn't even thinking of the result at that point. It was more for the experience for the students, but these guys just they just went for it. So it was a shock, it was a surprise that we actually took first place. But I think also our students are really, really extremely friendly, well behaved, and really sort of the model competitors for all of the other clubs. So the average age for ballroom dance in the U.S. is probably up in the 50s, 60s, right? So they all noticed that we had some of the best well-behaved students besides also the best ballroom dancers. So everybody remarked on that. This year was different. We had a bigger group. We doubled to more than 20, and we also added more dances and more levels. So it was a much bigger challenge this year. So yeah, we did suffer a little bit of growing pains in terms of, it was much more intense this year than we had last year. Of course, the expectations there as well. So yeah, it was a lot more challenging this year, but we still prevailed.
Andrew, anything you want listeners to know about ballroom dance?
Yeah, I think for me, ballroom dancing is really like this hidden gem tucked away in the world. It's like, I didn't know about ballroom dancing at all before, aside from an anime called Welcome to the Ballroom. That's why I knew it before. And I think if it weren't for Ravi and Cynthia being at UH, I would have never discovered just so much more to ballroom dancing, so much more that I still don't know about. So many dance styles, so many techniques, so many hours you can spend just learning about how to dance. And it doesn't really need, you don't need any dancing experience to learn ballroom. You just really need a drive to pursue it and love dancing, love the idea of moving the body the way you want and create this beauty through the way you move your body and just enjoy it.
And Mikaela, any final thoughts?
I think it's quite intimidating to go into ballroom because there's this expectation that you need another person there. I mean, it's a partner dance, so I mean, technically, yes, you do need another person. But I think especially with this club, you get the chance to socialize and meet a lot of people. And so you build your partnerships there. It doesn't have to be something that you already have to bring into the club.
Mm. Do the two of you plan to continue dancing after you graduate?
For me, it'll depend because I am going to the Air Force, and that depends if I will have time and depending on the location. But I think it would definitely be a cool hobby to keep off the side.
I'd definitely like to. I think it's my favorite thing that I picked up throughout college. So it'll be nice to be old like Ravi and Cynthia and dance.
Wait, what did you just say? Mikaela is very honest.
Thank you all so much for coming in studio. This has been great.
Thank you.
Those are members of the UH Ballroom Dance Club, Ravi, Narayan, Andrew Lin, and Mikaela Villanueva. They spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender recently. And we have videos of Andrew and Mikaela dancing in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. It'll be on our social media, so check it out. Well, that is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we cap off Earth Week with an underwater Hanaho show that celebrates our seas and the life within them. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.